Everyone, America, I'm an alcoholic. Glad to be here. Glad to be sober, Billy. Thanks for asking me to come out and spend a couple. I think it was before COVID since I was here last. So thanks. Good to see all of you again. And my sobriety day is December 2nd, 2001. I have a sponsor. I sponsor other men. Two of them accompanied me here tonight in case I had to fight my way out of here. So I'm glad they're here. They're big fellas. So, and my life was saved by Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I was thinking, you know, I was thinking the other day about all the times I've been in a pickle after having come to AA and how it saved my life. And I always think about this and I talk about it often at the end of my talk and I forget. And I will tell you that one thing that a story that really reminded of is when I was sober about, for many years, I was a professional. I got paid to ski. That was my job. I skied, right? And I had this opportunity when I was sober, maybe 4 months or something like that, to go skiing in Alaska, right? To go and ski some mountains that had never been skied before. And it was a big adventure. And I remember when I got the invitation, I said, you know, if I tell my sponsor about this, he probably is going to tell me I got to find meetings. And surely there aren't AA meetings in remote small town Alaska. And let me tell you, I have been around the world and I've been to every small town and there are AA meetings. It's like Fight Club. It's there, right? And but I was sure, and really, I was worried that he was going to suggest I don't go. And, you know, and I was going to go because I was a newcomer and that's what we do, right? And I remember, you know, I have a good sponsor and he was my second sponsor. I remember him telling me, you know, if you feel like drinking, if you feel, you know, call me and we'll, you know, we'll figure it out. And so I got snowed in. I was supposed to go to this little town called Valdez, Alaska. You've heard of it. A little drinker there had a little problem with a ship you may have heard of, right? So, and I was stuck in Anchorage, Alaska, beautiful place, but I was snowed in a hotel that had a gun shop and a couple liquor stores and a couple strip clubs and just all of my vices tied together, right? All at once. And I'm stuck in it. I'm 4 months sober, maybe three, maybe five. And my sponsors, you know, so I called him and I said, you know, I really feel like drinking. I think I'm in trouble. And he said, well, come pick me up and we'll go to a meeting together. Right. And I said, well, I'm in Alaska. He said, well, then you better ask for help. But he hung up the phone. This is old school AA. We were one of the gentle and kind back then, right? And you know, I did what we did back in those days, open the yellow pages, looking for AA. I could never figure out, it took me a long time to figure out until I knew about the traditions, why you can't really find AA in the yellow pages or the phone book. You find something similar to it, right? And I did what I learned to do then. I called a guy who called a guy who called a guy about a horse and someone picked me up in a pickup truck and took me to a meeting, right? And I was there and being at the meeting took some of the heat off, right? I was still thinking of drinking. I mean, it was on, right? The craving was really on. And I remember at the end of the meeting, we were saying the prayer. And like, I think just before we got to the end, I'm like, I really feel like drinking. That was me. Like, I'm not the kind of person that would make myself look bad that way. I'd rather drink than make myself look bad back in those days. And sure enough, you know, these two kind of crazy guys, and, you know, one was sober maybe 18 months and one was sober a few months. And they just, because I asked for help, they scooped me up. You know, we went to a coffee shop after the meeting. We chain smoked cigarettes and drank coffee. And then, you know, I got some sleep. The next day it was still snowing. I was still snowed in. We, you know, we got a bunch of automatic weapons and shot up some bottles because it's Alaska, right? Yeah. And had a good old time and smoked some more cigarettes. And then when the weather cleared, they saw me to the little airstrip, got me on my plane, and I got to Valdez, Alaska, where, by the way, they have AA meetings every day, right? Which I found out too. And I talk about that because when I was new, I got sober in Washington, D.C. area. I assumed that AA was like a city thing, right? It's there in big urban centers, and surely it won't be anywhere else. And it's been I've been to meetings now in every country or every continent except Antarctica, right? So AA is everywhere, doing fine. And you know, And I feel like I've been given a new life and a second life because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And like every alcoholic, I often forget that, right? And I get worried about, do I have enough money, and am I being perceived the right way, and is that person acting the right way? And so I wander from the path frequently, like many of us do. And if I'm around all of you, I can come back. But if I stay away from you, I haven't got a chance if I'm alone. My alcoholism wants to keep me alone. It wants to keep me away from the message of recovery. And eventually, we know how that ends. Thanks for having me tonight. We're delighted to be here with you. I grew up very much in the country. In fact, where I grew up makes this look like a real urban center, right? I grew up in sort of, they call it Pennsyltucky. It's where West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Maryland kind of meet on the Appalachian Ridge there. And we weren't from that area. My father is from Austria. My mom's from Vermont. My parents were like a couple of beatniks, started a little ski school in the mountains in Pennsylvania. And one of my first memories of school was that I actually had Lederhosen, which are these leather shorts that German and Austrian people have. And it was like the first day of kindergarten, and the kindergarten teacher thought it would be really great if I wore my Lederhosen to kindergarten, and called my parents an ass. And I was like, please don't make me wear my Lederhosen, right? I was, from the very beginning, like many of us, very self-conscious, very worried about what people thought of me, very worried about how I was perceived. And anywhere I wore my Lederhosen, and of course the kids made fun of me, like, you're wearing leather pants, why wouldn't they make fun of you, right? I grew up, I had a nice life. I have two loving parents. They're still alive. They're stubborn. They live in Utah now, and I can't get them out of Utah, even though they're in their late 80s. And I grew up in a little ski area. I couldn't have had a better upbringing, right? And a better, nice, I mean, it was the 1970s in rural Pennsylvania. It was poor, and I could come home from school and go skiing with my friends and go hunting and fishing and live a good life. And I could tell you, looking on that, even as a little kid, I just couldn't wait to get the heck out of there. I wanted something else. And because I was restless and irritable and discontented long before I took a drink, long before. And I, so I was, whether I was born with a spiritual malady or I developed it, as I was young, I needed something, to change me. And when I was a little kid, I tried different things. I was always an overachiever. I got really good grades. I did really well in sports. I did, but I just felt bad all the time, right? Again, two loving parents. I couldn't blame it on them. But again, I also grew up in this little ski area. So what's nice about growing up in a little ski area is that things are available to you at a young age, all things, right? And I was exposed to all things at a young age, and I was a very willing recipient, right? And by the time I was 15, I was drinking with some consistency. And drinking, if you grew up where I grew up, would mean people would have these weekend little townhouse or condos at the ski area, and they'd leave their beer out on the porch in a cooler, like in the snow. And so I was always small and light, so my friends would shimmy me up to the deck, and we would just throw down whatever was on the deck. So we always had a limitless supply of mostly beer and wine, right? And we were off to the races, and did other substances as well, but alcohol has always been center stage for me, right? And probably by the time I was 16 or 17, I could have qualified for the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I got sober when I was 32, many years later. And what I'll say is that, although I recognized pretty early, even by the time I was maybe 8 or 19, that when I took a drink, I just couldn't, I wouldn't stop until I got drunk. And many of us will say, well, I didn't, all of our friends drank to get drunk, so I didn't know the difference, but I did know the difference. Like, I played a couple sports at a pretty high level, and I was expected to be awake and alert on Saturday mornings or Sunday mornings. And I remember I'd be out drinking with my friends, like, be pretty tuned up, and I'd be like, I really, if I can get to bed by 11, I'll probably be good, you know? And then I'd be like, well, 12, 12's good. And then it was 1, and I'm like, well, if I get 2 or 3 hours of sleep, I should be fine, right? And so I did recognize, even way before I got sober, that like I couldn't always control how much I was going to drink. The truth is, I could never control how much I was going to drink. And you know, but I was still able to turn it off sometimes, right? When it was midterms or when it would matter at school. And I always had jobs. I was always working. I was always doing things. So I'm like, you know, I'm fine. Fine. I just like to drink. And I loved what alcohol did for me. I love the way it made me feel. I love that also. Just I told you about wearing the layers in kindergarten, that worried about what people think about me, that melted away when I drank alcohol. You know, it didn't make me feel like a superhuman or anything like that, but I just felt at ease. Alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I love the way it made me feel. I love the when I was with my friends, the conviviality, like all the things it talks about in the book, right? Drinking with your buddies, like having a good time, chasing girls, and just, you know, having a good time. And so my drinking, so through high school, my drinking was, I drank alcoholically, but I drank even as a periodic alcoholic, maybe we could say that time. I could turn it off sometime. Fast forward to college. I went to college in New Hampshire. I was supposed to ski race there. I was injured and I couldn't ski race. And I had seen the movie Animal House, and I thought that my college career was going to be just like Animal House. And sure enough, you know, first week there, they had freshman rush where you check out the different fraternities. And at the very end of fraternity row was my fraternity house, a couple of bunch of empty kegs in the front yard, you know, some mangy dogs running around. And I'm like, that's the one, right? Not the gentleman's house, not for me. And you know, I moved there, and I had an incredible opportunity my freshman year. Because I had been injured and I couldn't play the sport that I played my freshman year. That summer, I had an opportunity to go to South America, to Chile. A guy hired me to coach kids how to ski race down there, and I could train and get back in shape and go back to ski racing again my sophomore year. Well, I moved to Chile, and they drink this liquor there called Pisco. Don't know if you've ever had it before. It's pretty awful. They make it out of fermented grapes. I found Pisco and I found other things, and I had got a girlfriend, and needless to say, I never did one lick of training for ski racing, right? I was just crawling out of bed hungover to do my job, and obviously my drinking kind of hit a different level there, right? Didn't have any exams, didn't have any research papers that were due. I could just drink. I had to get up and coach ski racing in the morning, but you can do that terribly hungover. But I wasn't drinking in the morning or anything like that, and got back to college, and my drinking slowly progressed. And I graduated college, you know, like with a B C average, which is a miracle. And again, even like when it was midterms, when it was finals, I could turn off the drinking. I could do what I needed to do, and I could cram the information in and, you know, get by. And then it was time to, you know, grow up. Had a college degree. It's time to, you know, go get a job and do what you're supposed to do, what those normal people do, because they feel the calling of what they're supposed to do. And I remember I went to my first job interview. It was in Vermont. It was actually in the same town that Dr. Bob is from. And my family's from Vermont. And this was a like a setup job interview from a cousin or something. And I don't even know what the job, to this day, I don't even know what the job was because I wasn't interested, right? And even driving to the interview, which is about 2 hours from my college campus, I'm like, I thought, I don't want to work yet. Not like really work. I'll make enough money to drink and have a good life. And I was always, even in at that time, there was a fear of like, real job might get in the way of what I want to do, which is drink. I wanted to drink. So I went to the job interview. I didn't hear a word the guy said, but the next day I packed all my bags and I moved to Colorado, and essentially became a ski bum for 6 or 9 years. You know, I paid enough. I got made enough money to buy beer, to have rent. I would get these great jobs where I would teach skiing and train ski instructors around the world, I never made much money, but I made enough to get by and have a fun life. And I was also at this point now in my early 20s, always living in resorts, where people, when they're on vacation and living in resorts, they cut loose a little bit, right? So having a good time and drinking a lot was just normal. And again, my drinking sort of like kept progressing through this. And at this point, I would sometimes, my drinking would sometimes last for a couple of days, and I would go off the grid for a little bit, right? But I could always be charming and like get myself out of trouble and say like I had the flu. I was working in New Zealand for a while. They have a special expression for it down there. They call it the bottle flu, because if you were at the pub the night before and you called in sick the next day, they're like, yeah, Eric's got the bottle flu. It's the kind of flu that he's got. And on it went, right? And long story short is that my drinking got bad. I moved to the Washington, D.C. area because of a good friend of mine who was a fraternity buddy. He was starting another company and asked me to come help start it. And I, because I'd hurt my knee again, right? And I was like, I don't want to do this. So anyway, but I was there and it was fun. I thought, well, I'll party and live in Washington, D.C. for a summer, have a good time. And when I moved there, I'd saved some money, so I didn't really have to work for a couple of months. And you know how we are, we're not like thinking ahead at that phase of our life. Maybe I should work anyway and accumulate a little more money. I was like, I just, for the first time ever, I wasn't skiing. I wasn't, accountable for anything. My drinking went off the rails, just let loose. There was no job, there was no anything. And I was drinking in the morning, and I was drinking. And my good buddy, he was a recon Marine, and he was deployed sometimes. And I would house sit for him, which means I would drink his entire bar, and have escorts and things come to the house and start drinking in the morning. That's the, started at that time, and somewhere around there, I really started to want to stop drinking. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was already beyond the idea that I could control it. I wanted to just stop. I'm like, my drinking is out of control. I mean, I should say, some of the things that happened to me in that time is I would throw up blood sometimes, which is really frightening the first time you do it. It's a little bit frightening the second time you do it. By the third time, you're like, well, I'm still alive. I guess it's okay, right? And maybe it's I just got an ulcer, something like that, right? I would sometimes black out for a couple days at a time. My blackouts before that were always like, I'd be drinking at a bar 7 o'clock and I'd wake up in my bed, hopefully, right? That was like the blackout. Now, sometimes I'd wake up in a train station, right? And I was same thing too. The first time that you wake up in a urinal, those floor to ceiling urinals and you're lying horizontally, it's alarming. Second or third time, it's not such a big deal, right? And my drinking, I would also like to travel when I was a drinker. So I would, this was pre 9/11, right? So I would sometimes just get tuned up and drive to Reagan Airport and just back in the old days when you go to the counter and see if they had a discount flight somewhere. And I'd go to Vegas or I'd go to random places that just drink for a couple of days. I'd go on a hotel vacation where I just check into a hotel or a motel, get a couple bottles and just keep it running, right? And I started checking myself into deep to detoxes. I started going to hospitals a lot of the time, and it would usually look something like this. I'd check myself into a detox center. I would, have the Ativan. They give you an Ativan like every 3 hours, so you don't have a seizure, right? And it was just like just enough for like the first 30 seconds to take the edge off, right? That one Ativan, and I also started getting prescribed medications from the well-meaning doctors in those places, like things for as needed for anxiety. Alcoholics shouldn't have anything that says as needed on the bottle that alters your way of thinking or makes you comfortable, right? So I did a lot of as needed, and I did a little something because every time I got sober, I couldn't sleep really well. So a little something for sleeping too, right? And a little something for the depression, a little something for everything. And this went on and on. And so now I'm taking all this stuff and I'm drinking the way I always did. And now I'm really blacking out for days at a time. And my sometimes my actions, and I should say, like I was one of those drinkers that didn't get always in much trouble when I was drinking. I would do the Irish goodbye, you know what that is? Like I just kind of vanish sometimes and go home, and I'd wake up in my bed or in someone else's bed, and everything was fine. And at this time, though, I was starting to do some pretty bizarre stuff, taking all that as needed stuff and drinking on top of it. And so I ended up checking into this real highfalutin place called the Psychiatric Institute of Washington, right? Sounds like a center of higher learning. And what it really is just kind of like a public assistance for Washington, D.C. Employees of like the metro and things like that to it's an outpatient detox center. And I met the psychiatrist at the check-in. I think I was probably still intoxicated when I met with him. And I went voluntarily, I should say. And I said, I'm going to need, and I gave the name of all the prescriptions that I was taking. I need this for anxiety and I need this for my sleep, but I need this. He goes, I will write you a prescription. And I'm like, great. He said, for an abuse, right? And I had been on an abuse before. I even drank on an abuse once, and I don't wish that on anyone. And I said, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm just here to like, you know, just to chill out, right? He said, oh, you're not an alcoholic, but you're here, you know, for your drinking. And I said, yeah, that's right. And he said, okay, well then I'll just give you a prescription. He'd worked with a lot of alcoholics before. He knew what he was doing, right? And he kind of tricked me. He said, well then I'll just write you a prescription for an abuse. If you're not an alcoholic, you'll be fine. I said, I really need this other stuff if I'm not going to drink, because I just kind of like fall apart. And you know, I was somewhat honest, and he said, I'll just write you. We're just going back and forth about the abuse, right? He's just not yielding. And I said, he said, why won't you take the abuse? I said, because when I leave here, I can't know that I'm not going to drink. And he said, but you're not an alcoholic. And I said, that's right. And that's what I brought to you people, right? That's what came through the doors to Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God for how people in Alcoholics Anonymous work, how people are very tolerant of people like me when I was new, how people, although this was, you know, I think I first started coming around in the late 90s, it was still kind of old school. People were strict and whatever, but they recognized if you weren't ready and you were drinking at meetings or you were whatever, keep coming back. Is what I kept hearing. Keep coming back, right? And I did. And I wasn't. And I when I walked through the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't ready to go to any lengths to stay sober. I didn't know what alcoholism was. I thought it was drinking. I had a drinking problem, even though I had seen through my life that what happens when I stop drinking, how I would feel and what would happen. And many of us know and. The expression is when you stop drinking, you really see what alcoholism is if you're living without a solution, right? The expression used to be if you're not sure why you drink so much, just don't drink for a little while, right? And that would then that happened to me. So I thought something else was wrong with me, right? I keep stopping drinking and I keep feeling so awful. You guys say things like, don't drink no matter what. Do you know what I have? I do drink no matter what. Right. So I went to my first AA meeting. It was very close to the Psychiatric Institute of Washington because I thought they were watching as if they have time to check on every outpatient person that goes through. But I was a little paranoid too, because so I went and I didn't know what to expect. And I always tell this joke that it's not a joke. When I went, I was going to prepay. And if anyone's new in the room, there are no dues or fees for Alcoholics Anonymous. But I thought, if I prepaid my AA dues for 1 year, I'd have some skin in the game and maybe I'd go more often, right? And so I brought, and I didn't know how you would do that. So this is probably like 1999. And so I brought a wad of cash. I didn't know how much, maybe Alcoholics Anonymous is really expensive. I don't know. So I bought a blank check, a wad of cash, and a credit card. And I went to this meeting. It was called the Friendship Group, that the meeting still exists. It's right next to the National Cathedral on Wisconsin Avenue in DC. And at that time, there were several meetings there. It was a big, and there was a table, and there was a woman, some good members of Alcoholics Anonymous, looking for people like me, stragglers coming through the doors. And she said, "Oh, come on over this way." And you know, they had books and they had everything. And she said, "You know, do you have a big book?" And I said, "No, but I want to pay my I want to pay my AA dues. I really wanted to pay these dues, right? And like my initiation fees for a year. And again, if you're new, there's no such thing. But and she said, "Are you new?" And I was immediately resentful, right? Like, how could she assume that I was new? And then she kind of pointed down the hall to where the beginners meeting was. And so, you know, I walked down the hall angry that somebody assumed that I was new. And I was sitting in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a speaker discussion meeting. Those are pretty common in the DC area where someone will talk on a topic for 15 or 20 minutes, and then we open it up. And I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought it was a religious mint. I thought it was maybe like the Boston Church or something, you know. They sneak you in because you're desperate, and then they make you know, become religious. And I had a bunch of ideas, like many of us do when I walk through the rooms. And the woman that told her story was actually rather racy. And I was like, oh, well, that got my attention, right? And then what I noticed too, when she would tell stories that were about her drinking and things that happened, how people in the room would laugh, like a knowing, understanding laugh. The kind of thing that normal people don't laugh about when you tell them about something you did when you were drinking, right? Just they would laugh. And I was like, well, that's kind of cool. These people are, they're all right, you know? And there was compassion and understanding when she told her story. And then people shared, and they shared very honestly about stuff like how they felt insecure, how they felt like not being enough. And I remember just being embarrassed for them. Like, you shouldn't say that stuff, man. You keep that to yourself, you know? But like I said, I wasn't ready to be sober yet. And I remember after the meeting, this is kind of pre-cell phone, people were trying to get my phone number. And I was like, what? We just did the AA. I'll see you next quarter, whenever we meet next, you know? And so needless to say, I didn't stay sober, right? I went to a couple meetings. I never got a sponsor. I never, when people would suggest things to me, I'm just so not ready. I'm like, why are they suggest? What is a sponsor? What are they even talking about? I wasn't even angry. I was just like, no, man, I'm just trying to not drink. And needless to say, I was not successful at not drinking. And I drank again and again and again. And then I had like a really wild escapade at a, it's like a 3-day stint at a strip club called Southern Exposure in Southern West Virginia, and made it back and found the group of people where I got sober, which is the Midtown group in Washington, D.C., right? And went to a meeting, got kind of honest about where I'd been and what I'd done, and people kind of scooped me up and took me with them. And it was great because there were a lot of things to do. People were doing things. They were going to the beach on the weekend. They were going to conferences together. I was swept up in the fellowship. I was given a lot of service positions. I was doing service, but I still wasn't staying sober. I'd stay sober for a little bit of period of time, and then I would have a drink again. I wasn't really doing Alcoholics Anonymous. And although I had a sponsor, it was a sponsor in name only. And I just kept on drinking. And eventually I started to believe that I am perhaps one of those people that it talks about in the book that can't get this. Because again, I had a sponsor in name only, but I wasn't really sponsored. And I just kept drinking. And I would sit at these meetings and I would read the book and I would raise my hand. I would call myself an alcoholic. And so in my mind, I was working in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I wasn't staying sober, but I wasn't working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just thought I was. And it's because I was doing it my way and I was calling all the shots, right? And eventually some other stuff happened. I got the sponsor that I have today that some of you know, Arno. And it just, you know, we rode to the beach together one weekend and he just kind of 12-stepped me classically, right out of the book. And still I didn't stay sober with him as my sponsor, right? But I was doing stuff and I was there, and I really came to believe in my heart that like I'm just not gonna get this. Like, I'm gonna die of alcoholism. And what's the point anyway? What's the you know, I'm just not gonna get, I'm doing Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm working a program. But I wasn't. Just like my little story about Alaska, right? I was just doing things my own way. I was selecting what I would share with my sponsor and with others. I was selecting what I would talk about, and I was living like a bunch of different lives. I was lying about sobriety dates, right? I'd drink and then I wouldn't pick up a white chip, and then I would drink again, I'd put up a white chip. And to this day, when I have a drinking dream, my dream is that I'm sitting and I'm drinking. There's a drink in my hand. And I'm like, oh boy, I'm gonna have to lie about my sobriety date because I'm not gonna get honest, you know, almost 24 years sober, no chance of that. And in the dream, I'm like, well, when was my last sobriety date? And I realized I'd never stopped drinking, right? That it's all been a lie. And I've been drinking the whole time. And that's how my sobriety was from the time that I walked through the doors of AA until I got a sobriety date. Always a lie, right? And I mean, when I finally like cleaned out my house, when my wife moved, found an old cup full of like white chips and fake 30-day chips. And I think I maybe had one or two real 30-day chips, right? All fake and all a lie. And I was the guy that always smelled like alcohol at the meeting. And like, I wasn't fooling anybody. I remember I would chew Big Red and suck on a Halls at the same time. And I would try to inhale while I spoke, right? And, you know, keep coming back. Good to see you, Eric. Keep coming back. They even gave me the keys of the church to make coffee, right? When I was still drinking. But you know, people, again, I found a good group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I found sort of an AA village, and it takes a village to get an alcoholic sober. And you know, they didn't give up on me, even though I could be sometimes belligerent and argumentative. I remember they tried all different things. And finally, what they did is they gave me the key to this church that's actually near where I live now to make coffee for this noon Tuesday and Friday meeting. And I was like, these people don't even know I've been drinking, but they knew darn well that I've been drinking, right? But they just thought, maybe this will help, Eric. Maybe this will, you know. And I would tell you, on the times that I was drinking, I took that service position so seriously. I would come at 9 o'clock in the morning and make the coffee and then go back to drinking. I wasn't going to let the people down. It wasn't really, I didn't care that much about letting you down. I didn't want you to think that I was drinking. So, but I would come at 9 o'clock because there was no chance of running into somebody that was going to the noon meeting at 9 o'clock, right? But again, feeling as though I wasn't going to get this. This wasn't going to work for me, obviously, because I'm doing Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm making coffee. I'm calling my sponsor and telling him at least 30% of what's going on with me, right? And maybe 40 on a good day. And doing service and picking up new people and taking them to the meeting, even though I'm drinking and driving while I'm doing that, right? And I was going back to Pennsylvania for the winter to run this. You know, we had a couple of years that we were going to finish off this my parents' business. The contract was running out, so my sister and I ran it together, and lying to my sister and my family, of course, about being sober. And so my last drink, hopefully, was in a place called PR Shaboots, which is a roadhouse saloon off of Route 31, and it's actually right on the Appalachian Ridge. We're on one side of the parking lot, the water flows to the Chesapeake Bay, and on the other side, it flows to the Mississippi, right? And PR Shaboots had not paid their power bill for some time. So this was in December. Actually, it was November 30th, right? And so they were using those outdoor heaters as both light and heat. And it was kind of a strip club. It was like if you were a stripper and your career was over about a decade ago, it was the last stop where you might get a job, right? And so my last drink was a flat Milwaukee's Best in a plastic cup. And I hope that is my last drink. And so, like many of us, I didn't end with a bang. I ended with a whimper, right? And you know, that's a difference sometimes between a problem drinker and an alcoholic. Problem drinker, they get a DUI or they get a health scare with their liver, and they're like, oh my goodness, I gotta stop drinking. And they do, and they're fine, right? Maybe they go through a little DT, maybe they get a little edgy at first, but then they're just perfectly fine. And that scare keeps them sober for the rest of their lives, not us. I'd already had a lot of bangs before this plastic cup, right? And I went home, and my sister caught me, and I got real drunk by the time I got home. You know, the last drink was the plastic cup Milwaukee's Best, but before that, there were several pints of vodka. Right. And she caught me, and She got my parents on the phone. Here I'm this 31-year-old with on the phone with my parents and my younger sister, and they're like, what do you want us to do? We just send you to a rehab center? And my sister was all for that. And I said, no, I know what I got to do, right? And I'd been on about a 40-day bender at this point too. And I woke up in the morning and I was shaking pretty badly. And I took a couple of I found a I went in my parents' medicine cabinet, found a couple of those drowsy eye bottles, and just threw a couple of things down just to not have a seizure or something. I don't recommend that, by the way. If you're new, you should talk to your sponsor about how to do that. But then, the next day is my sobriety day. But I will tell you that during this time, I was certain I was not going to be able to stay sober because I'd been here and I'd done AA and it didn't work for me. And so the next day, my sister's giving me a hard time, as she should, right? And I drive to an AA meeting. I'm living up in really rural Pennsylvania, right? And I'm driving my truck like on dirt roads to get crossing the ridge. I'm cleaning ashtrays. I'm just getting a lot of service positions. I'm cleaning ashtrays. I'm making coffee. I'm cleaning coffee cups. I'm, sweeping up cigarette butts out of the parking lot. I'm getting busy in AA. I'm worried because I'm away from my home group, right? But again, like I said earlier in my talk, I asked for help. I was able to get honest with the people up in Pennsylvania because I just met them. I've been lying about my sobriety date. Not real. I'm just sober a couple days. I was not yet able to get honest with my people back home because of pride, of course, right? And I met this guy, Jerry. I mean, again, the heroes are everywhere in AA, right? He was keeping a lookout for people that needed help, and he sort of took me under his wing. He was kind of like a guy I could sort of lean on before I was able to call my sponsor and get honest. And Jerry had. He was a retired steel worker. He had two sons that were in prison for, drinking and drug things. Big old mountain guy, and I just the parking lot one night just because I was hurting so bad and so anxious and so worried about drinking again. And Jerry was like, you gotta call that sponsor and tell him. I'm like, oh, I don't want to do that. I don't want it. I don't want to. And he's like, I know you don't want to, but you better do it, right? And I did, and I thought I was gonna get a bunch of flack from my sponsor. And he didn't even say, looking back, of course he knew I was drinking. Everybody knew I was drinking, but he didn't say that. He just said, well, I'm glad you let me know, right? And we can keep going in the steps. And he said, how's that fourth step coming, I was supposed to be working on? I said, great, I'm almost done with it. And I had not started it at all, right? And of course, newcomers, right? So don't trust them at all. And so he said, well, great. And he knew the kind of alcoholic what I was. He knew what he was working with. He said, well, great, then why don't we do your fifth step next week down here at my apartment in Bethesda? And I said, that's a great plan, and I was like, I should start writing. And I will tell you, it had been months and months and months when I was working on my fourth step and I was doing nothing, right? I was chasing girls in AA is what I was doing mostly, right? And so when I put pen to paper and wrote my fourth step, it didn't take me that long, right? When I actually started taking action. And I would say that, the first three steps are incredibly important to get us to where we are, but their admission, their acceptance, they're not like a physical action. Putting the pen on the paper and writing was a physical action. And I wrote my four. I'd love to tell you that as I was writing it, I had a great revelation, but you're talking again to a guy who was sober like a couple of weeks, still very foggy and cloudy and still pretty much sociopathic, right? And we went and I did my fifth step. And I heard people share that sometimes you do that fifth step and like a great weight is lifted and you feel, and I felt just kind of sick after I did it. I'm like, I told this guy all this stuff and none of it was super dramatic. It was just a laundry list of a petty, insecure, selfish prick, right? Which is how I live my life. And a list of fears and I skipped the sex inventory altogether. Not because I meant to, but again, I was just sober a couple of weeks. So, and quite honestly, at 3 weeks sober, that was just fine because that was something I had to get to later. And really engage in with my sponsor. And so I drove back up to Pennsylvania, 3.5 hours, but I did not stop at my normal stop in Frederick, where I'd pick up six pack. I didn't stop at Breezewood, Town of Motels, the Ramada Inn, where I would always stop for a couple of pops, right? I did not stop, on the way home. I didn't stop and get a pint. I made it home. But again, thinking that I'm screwed, this isn't gonna work. Did this fist step, I didn't feel any weight lifted, I'm whatever. What I realized as the winter was coming to an end and I was going to be moving back to DC, that it had been 3 months and I hadn't had one of those overwhelming urges to drink. The kind when your car just drives itself to the liquor store. The kind where I'm not going to tell you that I feel like drinking after the meeting. The kind where I'm going to drink no matter what. And those are the things that would always overcome me. And when people would say things like, don't drink no matter what, I would think, do these people not have what I have? I'd always think that. I hated that expression, don't drink no matter what. I'm like, I get these urges and I do drink no matter what. And I'm not going to tell you because I don't want you to stop me. But it had been 3 months and the taking that fourth step, sharing that with my fifth step, that fifth step with my sponsor took off enough heat for me that I no longer had those. I still had cravings to drink. I still, my office of the ski school was about from here to where those chairs are to the entrance of the little bar at the ski area. See people going in and out of there having a good time. And I'd see people drinking on a movie and I'd have a craving, but I no longer had those overwhelming urges to drink, But I couldn't have put that into words then. I was just like, well, I guess I'm lucky. I got lucky, right? But the truth is, and that fifth step started a semi honest dialogue with a sponsor. And I will tell you that my conversations with my sponsor early on were just lots of arguments, arguing with him, debating with him, debating like, how could I? And a lot of stuff he's like, well, you can always just keep doing what you're doing, right? He had that leverage on me. I wanted to be sober at this time, right? And it was like, hey, man, like you can do whatever you want. I'm not your PO, right? Go for it. Do whatever you want. You know the results that will get you. And click. And that's, we even think we have, that was near the end of dial tones, right? When someone could hang up and you could hear a dial tone. Now you just hear silence. Maybe they dropped the call, right? It was deliberate. And I got home, and I got busy, got busy and started doing some amends and, went through six and seven and doing all this stuff and starting to feel good, getting busy in AA. And then my life got good, so who needs AA? Plus, you pathetic people sitting in these churches, being all happy, being sober. I've got big plans. I'm going to be somebody, And so then, secretly, probably about a year and a half sober, I had made a decision to leave AA. I was just gonna, and I had, it was going to be tough because I was doing a lot of service. All my friends were AA members, right? I was doing stuff with AA. We were going to conferences, we were doing things, but I had bigger plans, right? And I had plans for me. There was more me stuff that had to happen, right? So I didn't know how it was going to work out yet, but I was going to do it, right? And God works in mysterious ways, and I mean that has been my expression, my experience in AA, that God works in mysterious ways in my life. So when I literally, a couple of days after I made this plan, someone asked me to speak at this meeting called the Little Flower Meeting. Now, this meeting was a meeting that was at the end. You know how some meetings die quickly, some die slowly. This was one. It was a room about three times this size, and you stood up on a stage with a podium like this, and there'd be like four guys sitting in chairs, right? And so it was really awkward. And I remember I was there, and I told my little story, and at the back of the room was a little blonde-haired kid. He's not a kid. He's like 23, 24 years old, sitting there with what appeared to be his mother. And when the meeting was over, I saw her like go, like basically kick him in the butt and say, go talk to that guy, right? And so he asked me to sponsor him. And now I knew enough about AA that I couldn't just kick him to the curb and leave AA right away. So my second new plan was, this was Andrew. His name was Andrew. I said, I'm going to get Andrew connected to Alcoholics Anonymous. Then I'm going to leave. And we all know how that story ends, right? So for the first time ever, I was picking this guy up and taking him to meetings, and he was a pain in the neck. always arguing with me and never wanted to do anything. And you know, I introduced him to my friends. I started doing, having him do service with me, and I started, you know, taking him through the steps. And sure enough, you know, when I started taking him through the steps, my conviction of the program, the steps, and how it works was increased tenfold, right? And Andrew stayed sober for almost 8 years, and I still stalk him on Facebook to see how he's doing. He's not doing well, right? Unfortunately. And, you know, thus started my journey and being of service to others at AA. And we learn here that what's wrong with us, or what's wrong with me, is that the reason I'm so self-conscious, the reason I care about what other people think about me, the reason I'm all these things is because I'm thinking about myself all the time. And unchecked and without something to come between me, and that's the higher power that I've met here in Alcoholics Anonymous, or God as I call him, from taking the steps, I'm going to go back to that selfish person over and over and over again. And I'm going to worry about me, and I'm going to stay up at night, not sleeping, tossing and turning, not because I'm worried about you, because I'm worried about me, you know? And when I take the time to take the call of another alcoholic, to work with someone new, to make coffee, to clean up chairs, to do something, I get a temporary break from that selfishness. And I get a chance to be of service to God and to my fellows here in AA. And hopefully, if I grow a little bit spiritually in time, I can carry that spirit of service out into the world, right? And take it to all, practice it in all of my affairs, right? I don't know about anyone here, the most challenging place for me to practice is at home with my wife, who's also a member of AA. And I frequently want to tell her to call her sponsor, but I know better, right? And I got my program and she's got hers. And probably if she were to tell me to call my sponsor with greater frequency, she'd probably be right, right? She is the better half. There's no doubt about that, right? And, you know, my wife and I met in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think she was sober 4 or 5 years when we met. When we took our honeymoon, we made sure that it was going to be near somewhere where there was an AA clubhouse, where every morning we went up. And so we honeymooned in Indonesia, right? And we didn't know anything about Indonesia, but it seemed like a cool place to go, right? And because we ended up paying for our own wedding, because the family dynamics were getting kind of weird and there were a lot of strings that were going to have to be pulled, I'm like, we're just going to do a simple wedding, pay for it for herself, and go after a honeymoon. And because we went to the AA clubhouse, you know, first thing in the morning before we had breakfast, we met these crazy Australian guys and this guy that lived in the North Shore of Hawaii that were AA members. And they took us to all the coolest spots in Bali that aren't on any tour guide, that aren't on any map, right? And typical crazy alcoholics, you know, those were our tour guides that became our friends in our honeymoon. And we went on and, you know, and we went through great things in Alcoholics Anonymous at you know, when we were sober several years, our younger son was diagnosed with cancer when he was 17 months old, and things didn't look good for a long time, right? And like always, people in AA showed up. People in our religious and spiritual lives showed up, right? People would say things like, I will say a prayer for you or your son, and that never meant anything to me. I'm always like, that's nice. What does that even mean? Until my son had cancer. And I was like, please do, you know, and thank today he's 10 years old. He's doing great. You know, but he had a really bizarre form of lymphoma that had a lot of weird mutations. And even though we live right next to the National Institute of Health and we have, you know, great children's hospital up there, they didn't know for many years how that would go. That was tough for both of us, right? It was wanting to practice the third step, wanting to say, I'm okay if my son lives or dies, it's God's will. Not easy, right? But eventually, like everything I've gone through in AA, I got to a place where I was just spinning so badly and I was so uncomfortable and afraid that I had to do it. I had to say that prayer, right? I had to let him go. I had to give him to God and not try to cure him myself, which I couldn't do. And he lived, right? That experience was a pretty big strain on our marriage for my wife and I. It's tough when you're taking care of like a really sick kid. And we got through that too, you know? And, you know, I think about where my AA life is today at almost 20, 4 years sober if I make it. And I would love to tell you that I just walk on the clouds today. I wake up in the morning and the first thing I think about is how I can be of service to others. And when I wake up at, 4 o'clock in the morning for my fourth or fifth pee of the night, that I'm, that when I get back to sleep, I first thing I think is like, everything's going to be okay. Thanks, HP. And my head hits the pillow, but it's not true, right? I still often make the choice, and the choice that we get to make frequently here is, do I want to live peacefully now in the moment, or do I really want to think about this thing that I want to happen a certain way? And am I going to let the thought of whether that thing does or doesn't happen a certain way get me all wound up and ruin my day? And it's a choice that someone who's sober a while should be able to make easily. It's a choice that someone who has felt great peace and ease and felt in the presence and a connection with a higher power and knows what peace that brings should easily make. But how frequently I will go back to focusing on how I want things to be, how I want people to act, how I want a certain outcome to be, right? And to me, that's really has become, the great, the sort of the last frontier for me. Like, do I want to? It's almost like when you're new and you get an argument, your sponsor will always say, "Do you want to be right or do you want to be free?" And when you're new, you're like, "Right, definitely right, right?" And then you learn that actually freedom feels a lot better than being right. But still, as we go through life, things will come up where I want things to go a certain way, and I don't want to be free. I want to be right. Until I get wound up enough that I know who to turn to and what to do. And, and if I am to share anything with you tonight, I remember that there was a guy named Frank B or Frank Benet, who you probably had to speak here, Billy, who was kind of like a second sponsor to me. He was like my papa, if you will, in AA. And Frank would always say, "I'm perfect. I'm a perfect example that you can stay sober for many years and not amount to a hill of beans," right? But that guy probably saved thousands of alcoholics. He would take you, he'd make you an open-faced roast beef sandwich. He was a great cook, right? And he had this couch that he called the crying couch, right? Sit on the crying couch and tell Frank what was going on. I think about he, I remember once we were driving through this expensive neighborhood, and my default setting is workaholic, right? I will work and work and work and try to achieve and achieve and achieve at the expense of those around me, right? Including my family. We were driving through this really expensive neighborhood once, and this, I was sober maybe 3 years. And he goes, "Eric, one day you'll probably live in a house like that." And I was like, "Thanks, Frank." He goes, "Or you'll be dead." But at that time, being a newcomer, I was like, "Frank thinks I'm gonna live in a house like that. That's pretty sweet, right?" So, and I was like, "Thanks, Frank." And he said to me, "You're not ready for that lesson yet, right?" And I'm thankful that there have been so many patient people with me in this program, right? And I'm thankful, and I hope that you too find a village, right? I've gone through periods in AA when I didn't want to be around my home group, and in DC, it's really easy that you can go to meetings day or night, not quite 24/7, but anytime. Don't want to run into anyone in your home group, no problem. You go to another meeting down the street. There have been times I'm like, I'm tired of these people. I need to find a new home group. I need to find, these people are boring. They don't stimulate me enough, right? And really what's going on is I'm getting uncomfortable, or I'm covering something up. I'm not being completely honest with people. So I would say having a home group or a village, or having people that you see consistently, having a service position in that home group, having guys that I sponsor, right? Calling my sponsor with greater frequency, hopefully, right? Means the world to me. And knowing that, what's great about AA is that at the end of the meeting, when I'm holding hands, saying a prayer, I might be holding hands with a Republican and a Democrat and a priest and a atheist and a whatever. Everyone is represented here. And all of that stuff, it's hard right now to escape politics and all that stuff. That stuff stays in the car. Right here, we have a singleness of purpose. Here, unlike many, many places right now, people that have differing opinions can coexist because we have a singleness of purpose. We have a place to be. We have a message that we need to carry and that we need to stay alive, right? So I'm thankful that you guys are all here tonight to bring that message to me. So thanks much.